Welcome to Inflection Point Podcast, where our mantra is cultivating change from the inside out. Join your hosts, Anita Russell, Mavis Bauman, and Gail Hunter, as we create a brave space for conversations about racism, personal transformation, and accountability. Conversation provides a means to dive deeply into your thoughts, ideas, and beliefs and examine what emerges in your words, actions, and behaviors. The show is a journey towards anti-racism by cultivating change within yourself first and then out into the world. Learn to engage in racial dialogue using four tools: courage, conversation, relationship, and accountability. Discover how truth, reconciliation, and healing can emerge from honest and deliberate conversations. Manifest social change right now on Inflection Point Podcast. Well, hello, hello, and thank you for joining us for yet another episode of Inflection Point Podcast. I'm your host, Anita Russell, and here's a quick hello from my counterparts, Mavis and Gail.
Hi, everybody. I'm Mavis Bauman.
Hi, I'm Gail Hunter, and welcome.
Yeah, so again, if you have been following us, you know that we have some really, really interesting discussions, interesting topics, historical information, and all of that. And today is no different. So we're actually focusing on something that has been in the news quite a bit lately, but it's also something that has a very deep and extensive historical context. So we're going to talk from that perspective initially. And the general topic is the plight of Black farmers in the United States. And so as I was putting the information together, and usually when we do this, we, you know, come up with a topic and we go out and find resources that help us to tell the story. So for us, it's always about telling the story, right? And so one of the videos that I watched, it was a gentleman by the name of John Boyd, and he is the president of the National Black Farmers Association. And he made a really interesting statement in a video that I had watched. And we're going to talk about that video a little bit later. But he talked about the footprint of slavery, sharecropping, and peonage. And so peonage is probably a term that most people are not exactly familiar with, right? Some people may understand the concept of sharecropping, but peonage is a little bit different from that, right? But it all kind of goes back to the Civil War. I mean, just think about it. So many things that we experience today literally go back to pre-Civil War era, the Civil War era, Reconstruction, and all of that. And so much of our history in the United States flows from all of those early historical events. And that includes, obviously, slavery. It includes things like the sharecropping and all of that. But one of the things that it also includes is the 40 acres promise. And probably most of us, when we think about history, the way we learn history, sort of that version of history where it's based on these milestone events rather than this culmination of events that were happening over the course of time, right? And so one of those is the Emancipation Proclamation. So everybody kind of sort of has heard of that. But I would venture to say that the average person doesn't really understand what the Emancipation Proclamation was all about. We've talked about that in the past. But one of the things that links to the Emancipation Proclamation is the 40 acres promise. And I believe it was General Order 15 that stated that these newly freed individuals were going to be given these 40 acres of land for them to be able to work the land, start, creating a business for themselves, so to speak, and all of that, just to kind of assist with this transition from being enslaved to now being in this state of so-called freedom, right? And so the 40 acres was promised, but the assassination of Abraham Lincoln occurred. And when the assassination of Abraham Lincoln occurred and the presidency then shifted to Andrew Johnson, Andrew Johnson had a slightly different approach, if you will. And he was from the South, and things began to turn around a little bit, and land that had been given was then taken back, right? So if you think about that promise, which is the beginning of all of this stuff that we're going to talk about, but that promise, that broken promise, became the seed for the mistrust that exists in this country today between Black folks, the government, police, and all of that. Like, that mistrust didn't just grow out of itself. Mm-hmm. It grew out of these types of experiences and all of that. So let's shift the conversation a little bit about and talk sort of how we got from the 40 acres promise being repealed. Then we went to Reconstruction. Out of Reconstruction came the Black Codes. Out of the Black Codes came Jim Crow. Out of the Jim, all of that came the Great Migration. All of those things contributed to this footprint that Mr. Boyd was referring to when he was talking about that footprint of slavery and how that footprint has made its way through all of these generations right up into 2020. So Mavis and Gail, talk to me. Give me some of your thoughts on this particular topic. And I just love the way he framed it up, the footprint of slavery.
All right. You want to go, Gail, or should I take a stab at it?
Go ahead if you want to. I'll go next.
Well, I come to this content as the child who grew up in farming country. And I never saw a Black farmer in my whole life. So this was really a new subject for me. And, as I thought about how when slaves were newly freed, what they were able to do, the skills they had, that it only made sense for them to start with some land, versus absolutely nothing. And so, it certainly made sense for them to have the 40 acres. And then when they're gone, then what? Well, like you were mentioning, Anita, the Great Migration, focusing on my part of the country, Nebraska, Iowa, Colorado, I did see that part of the Great Migration was the meatpacking industry that pulled people up into that area. But also, there was the Homestead Act of 1862, which was available to newly freed slaves. They had to promise anyone who got, one of the homesteads had to promise to develop it, to build a house within a certain period of time. And if they didn't, they were charged a fee. So I would love to look into that more in terms of what Black people were able to do under those circumstances. Did they hold them out of the Homestead Act because they didn't have the small starter fee? I'm not sure. But like I say, I never saw a Black farmer in, west of the Mississippi for sure. And my former in-laws were on both sides were homesteaders. So they both families did get 160 acres and farmed them to this day. And there is that generational wealth that is able to be passed down then. Yeah, so I'm going to stop with that there. I want to add some more later. Mm-hmm. But I just thought it was fascinating how there were facilities to bring Black farmers into the rest of the country, but the same old discrimination, theft, outright lying, promises not observed, There was something about in 1920, there were 300 farmers in this particular county in Iowa, and by 2017, there were 23. So over the years, it just is encroached upon. And it's interesting to look at the reasons for that.
Absolutely. Gail, did you have something you wanted to add?
Yeah, I mean, just reading more about this, it doesn't surprise me because it fits right into what we have learned and what we've talked about as far as how not just people that were white and from the South still held on to the beliefs of white supremacy, but the government mm-hmm. was behind it also and participated in this to give land and then take it back, to tax, to fine somebody for certain things that were never fined for somebody that was white, and then to accrue that debt caused people that were black to never ever be able to truly be free and truly own what they were supposedly given or what they had. So the whole system was set up to fail anyone who's black, the whole system. And it continued on throughout those years, those decades. And even up until
white people were the government too. Right. You know, it's you kind of tend to want to separate the government as a, you know, free operating organization, but it's us. We voted people in, and they were, I'm sure, pretty much white at that time too.
Well, even after they were given the ability to be in Congress and so forth, it didn't take very long for the black people that were to stop being there.
Yes, exactly.
Because of the reality of that racism and prejudice and
manipulation. Fear of black people being successful.
Exactly. And you know, it showed up. Right. It showed up in black codes.
Oh, definitely.
So now all of this policing of our behavior, monitoring what we're doing, what we're allowed to do, what we're not allowed to do, and all of that. It was built into the legal system.
Mm-hmm. It was
built into the legal system. Black people can't do this. You can't do that. And when you think about the whole thing with peonage, so I'm actually going to explain that for people who may not really know
what
it is. I just learned it like last week myself. So, but basically, and it ties into black codes. So coming out of Reconstruction, now our behavior is policed and codified into laws, right? Governing what we can and cannot do. And part of that was this system that was created where if you broke one of these quote unquote black code laws, now you're fined, right? And now you have a debt. So that debt becomes a fine for you. Or I'm sorry, that fine becomes a debt for you.
Yeah.
And so now enter this white person who decides to pay that debt on your behalf, but now you're beholden to the individual who paid that debt on your behalf. So now you're in a system where you're right back kind of where you started from, because now this person owes you because you owe him this debt. And now the way that you work, that you pay off that debt, is by continuing to be enslaved.
Slaved. Debt servitude is the word that.
Exactly. But the point that I'm making is that whole system that allowed that to happen was built into the law.
The black code.
Mm-hmm. And the injustice and the inequity in it, that two or three black men sitting in a corner talking could be arrested, and two or three white men would never be arrested.
Right.
And those are the black codes are really almost ridiculous in what they did. But the reality is that you're right, that they were fined, and then white people came in and paid off the fine. But then the black people never knew, was their fine ever paid off by the work? Because they were working for free, basically, in order to pay the debt off. But that debt kept increasing. The thing is that the cost of products was higher for black people, and they didn't make as much on their crop as what white people did. And so it was infiltrating everywhere.
They were discriminating.
And the government,
the market. in terms of price for their goods.
And people, not only that, but like if you think about today, like you can go online and you can check your credit report. Like, you know, all of the debt that you have, you they didn't have that. The people that held that debt, they could tell you anything. They could tell you anything. Oh, no, 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 no. That crop that you just brought forth, that really wasn't enough to pay off the debt. So you're going to have to work with me for another year. Oh, no, 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 no. Because, you know, expenses,
that's a good point.
You know, your credit and all of these things, everything is, you know, we talk today, you think about the economy. Everybody talks about inflation and all of that, which is kind of sort of like questionable in general. Because if you're the one that's controlling the economic system and how it works, then you're the one who can manipulate that system.
Yes.
And in this case, with the peonage, right? And then there are, during this research, we read a couple of stories of individuals who literally came out of the peonage system in the 60s.
In the 60s.
So we looked at an article, Black people in the U.S. were enslaved well into the 60s.
1960s. That's.
Yes. 1960s.
Right.
Like all three of us were alive.
Yeah. Right. Think of that. Think of that.
Exactly.
Slavery in the 1960s.
And not just, that they were enslaved, but they were brutally.
Yeah. They were brutalized.
Right. Mm-hmm. They were beaten.
Exactly. So again, to Brian Stevens's point, everything just evolved. It just evolved. Nothing really shifted. Nothing really changed. It took on a different form, right? And all of this right up until today. So you can see the validity of Mr. Boyd's statement when he talks about that footprint of slavery, and that footprint of slavery and everything that we just talked about leads to mistrust. Why should we trust white people? Well, why should we trust the government? Why should we trust? You got redlining, you got all kinds of things that did nothing to benefit us.
Even slavery would make me never trust anybody, you know, from the get-go. But you want to believe that you can actually get out of it, I'm sure, at the time, and that these people are promising you things and they'll deliver on it.
Right. Yeah. But then they don't.
But then they don't.
But then they don't. But the thing that I always focus on in a lot of these conversations also is the idea that we never stop fighting.
Yeah.
We never stop fighting. If you just look at even, you know, from the time period that we were talking about, from the 40 acres, that time period through the civil rights movement and, you know, what we're going through today, it's all the same story.
Right.
It's just being continued. This is the 21st century version of that story.
Existing.
And the fighting has to continue.
Yeah. Black people have never stopped fighting for their rights.
Right.
The rights of any human being.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
The birthrights.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And so even now according to the Constitution, their rights. Right.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. So let's shift the conversation a little bit and dig a little bit deeper into what's happening today. So we found an article that was describing Black farmers in America from, let me see if I can find it, from 1865 to the year 2000. And one of the things that it talks about in the abstract of this paper is Black farmers in America have had a long and arduous struggle to own land and to operate independently, right? And so, and again, it starts to go into, you know, the Civil War, even economic and social barriers, et cetera, et cetera. So many things that we just talked about. But one of the things that really jumped out at me when I was reading through some of this is that in the summary of this article, there's a statement that says independent farmers belong to a broad economic class of owner-operated small businesses. So I would bet that a lot of people don't necessarily think of farmers as small business owners. Yeah. Right?
Right, but they are. Of course they are.
But they are. Mm-hmm. And so when you think about capital, when you think about all of the, you know, like stuff that we've gone through just in the last 2 or 3 years with the pandemic and, you know, food shortages, supply chain and blah, 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 and all of that. And you think about all of the businesses that were struggling financially, farmers were struggling also.
Sure.
Right?
Well, and they've been struggling also with the climate crisis and what's been going on with the weather and the crops and so forth. And, you know, at different levels, they've been struggling.
Exactly.
I remember in the 80s, you know, a lot of farmers were forced to sell their mm-hmm. equipment, and there was this huge crash and then more and more competition globally. I can't mm-hmm. imagine how Black farmers survived at all. But I did see something about cooperatives. I didn't.
Yeah.
I didn't get into that subject all that deeply, but that makes sense to me that they would, you know, come together to, you know, deal with these struggles, financial support, and so on.
Exactly. So just thinking about, you know, what you just said, how things were literally just falling apart. But as things were falling apart, so when you think about the economics of like real estate and all of that sort of thing. So when things are falling apart and people are losing their homes and people are going into foreclosure, on the flip side of that are the people who are now buying those properties.
Yeah.
So they're getting those properties at a fraction of their worth and their value. And so now you've had instances where it may have been three generations of farmers, and because of the economics crises and things like that that we find ourselves in, they're now compromised. They lose their land, and somebody else, oftentimes a white person, will come in and take that land.
That's true in most industries, right? They just kind of scavenge people who are not able to service their debt.
Or they'll buy it and then the farmer can rent it from them. And that's when they then begin to accrue more and more, right? And it never gets paid off.
Right. And so the whole idea of the land being tied to generational wealth, when you have racism built into a system that impacts certain people, they struggle. And that generational wealth gets lost. And that, to me, is part of what Mr. Boyd and the Association of Farmers and all of them coming mm-hmm. together, because the latest thing in the news is that they work with Benjamin Crump, the civil rights attorney, and they filed a class action lawsuit against the United States government because of funding that was earmarked for debt relief. And isn't that what we're talking about? Yes. Debt relief, you're trying to hold on to your land. So things were promised. And then what happens? You have white farmers who decide
that
they're being discriminated against. Mm-hmm. So then they go to conservative courts, get conservative judges. And then the government repeals and changes the language. So now the language becomes distressed farmers. That's a far cry from non-white farmers.
Right.
To just being distressed, because distress is a very diluted kind of term. And it doesn't really address the footprint.
The footprint of slavery.
It doesn't address it at all.
I was wondering, I didn't really come across anything on this, but farm subsidies that have been given to, I know, white farmers, I don't know if Black farmers ever received those, when they're basically, you know, supporting the price so that they can afford to keep farming. I wonder if they ever received any farming subsidies in any equitable way.
Well, and that's a really, really good question. It isn't something that I necessarily looked at, but
I didn't either. Yeah.
I would venture to say that the answer is probably not so much, simply because of racism. You can't ignore the fact that this is race-based. You can't ignore that.
Right.
Right? And so even if there were some farmers over here that were getting that benefit, because white farmers have gotten that benefit, hence the need for this is what we need to do to service non-white farmers, right? Black farmers, Hispanic farmers, whatever, that don't fit into that mold of whiteness.
I just was thinking about a film clip that I saw of someone trying to save their farm, a black farmer, and then trying to sell his equipment, probably to service his debt, you know, to just keep the land. And his particular equipment was pushed to the back of the lot at the on the day of the auction, and someone had inscribed KKK on the equipment itself, and it never sold.
Right, it couldn't.
We just can't imagine that happening today. But there are ways to keep people down.
Can't imagine that happening today.
I don't want to.
I can't imagine it happening today. Right. Like those things, like none of this ever surprises me. All it really does is re-emphasize the idea that the nucleus of all of this is the belief in white supremacy.
It is. That's what infiltrates all of these choices. From the government on down, it is about white supremacy.
Exactly.
And the belief that white people are entitled and are better than, and I could go on and on, but,
More skilled at, more deserving of.
The lie that keeps on being alive. And Virginia's a lie, and to serve greed and many other things, and it's still active,
right?
And maybe not
exactly. Exactly. So we have about another minute or so before we go to break. So Mavis, can I ask you to share the story about your friend and the cafe, the coffee cafe?
Oh, sure. I just considered it a little success, and I just want to encourage everybody who's listening. He's a friend who every now and then has been listening to our podcast. I've known him for many years, very open-minded, very loving man. And, you know, at the outset, he said he did not believe he was a racist. And as he's been listening to our podcast, he is starting to notice his own thought patterns, which is really exciting. He told me this week that he went to a black cafe and poet place in Washington, D.C. And he said, you know, I used to love places like that when I was in New York or, you know, in other cities. And he said, when I walked in, I thought, there's a lot of black people here and they're smart. So he caught himself having that thought. Those are the kinds of things that are in us, even if we think we're not outwardly racist. It's in there. And I was just excited for him. We're just looking at the world in a different way. We're looking at our thoughts and our beliefs in a different way. So yay.
Yeah, that was like a really cool story when you shared
that. I was happy to hear it too.
Yeah.
I said it gave me fuel to keep going on, because it's not just the obvious things you would think, not a racist joke. It's much deeper in us than we realize.
Right, because if it was all mostly filled with white people, he would never would have thought anything about how intelligent these people were, right? But it was like almost like a surprise and awareness. Right.
So he's intentionalizing a weekly visit there just to listen and chat with people, see what they're thinking.
Cool. So this is a good place for us to take a break, and we'll see you in a minute or so.
Sounds good.
Take control over your future. I'm Lisa Belts, and I'm here to help you realize your true potential and become unshakable. Schedule a completely free introductory coaching session with me now to see for yourself how I work. Get the divine guidance that you need to transform your life for the better. Go to lisabelts.com and take that step towards transformation. That's LYSABELTZ.com.
I'm Mark Fechner, and at the Business Mind Show, we focus on real people with real issues, and we tackle those issues in real time. I don't have the answers. I help you find the answers within you. Sometimes all that is needed is just a slight change in perception. To find out more about my coaching, go to markfechner.com. The Business Mind Show airs the second and fourth Tuesday of every month on transformationtalkradio.com.
Imagine what it would be like to turn your pain into purpose. Tune in to Transformation with Martinet every second and fourth Friday at 10 a.m. Pacific on TransformationTalkRadio.com. Martinet and her guests are here shining their lights today through empowering stories of hardship and transformation. Begin to see your life in a new light. Visit MartinetEmmons.com and tune in every second and fourth Friday at 10 a.m. Pacific to Transformation with Martinet.
Damayanti is the place for your soul, where you'll find inspiring reminders of your inner beauty and strength. Made in America and shipped directly from us to you, our unique collection of Sanskrit mantras speaks of pure love, resilience, divine energy, and more. Damayanti, join us as we take our soul journey together. Go to damayanti.store now to find the special mantra that speaks to your soul.
Tune into the Life Strategy Show with your life strategy mentor, Lolita Smith, and say yes to bringing prosperity and success to your future right here and right now. Life is a picture of your mind, and Lolita is here to help you imagine it. Say goodbye to the strings of the past that have been holding you back for far too long. Rise up with Lolita and say yes to the solutions, prosperity, and unlimited possibility. Visit LifeStrategyMentor.com. That's LifeStrategyMentor.com.
So welcome back. You are listening to Inflection Point Podcast on Transformation Talk Radio. And our topic for this evening is the plight of Black farmers in the United States. And we've been talking extensively about the footprint of slavery, sharecropping, and peonage. So I'm going to shift the conversation a little bit, and I'm going to pass the baton over to Mavis, because Mavis is going to share a little bit more information about her upbringing in Nebraska. And she has a really, really good story to tell that is going to kind of bring all of this together, if you will.
Great. Thanks, Anita.
Oh, Mavis.
Thanks. This really does hit home. Most of my parents' extended family were farmers. My nuclear family was not, but I just feel very tied to the land still myself. I think we both came across things, Anita, that said that land is power. Mm-hmm. And I remember thinking that I was growing up, if you had land, you always had some place to be and some way that you could, something that you could cultivate and earn money. So in my research, I really focused, I started in Nebraska, and then I saw articles about the Midwest, and a particular story about Iowa came up that I thought was pretty fascinating. It is about the Stepp family in Fayette County, Iowa. They had been farming a piece of land for more than 120 years, growing watermelons, and it was a very profitable business. Mr. Stepp was an African-American. I believe his wife was white. They launched Watermelon Days, and that was celebrated for years. You know, it was part of the culture. And in the writer says that, you know, the white farmers and the Black farmers just kind of left each other alone, and they all did their own thing. You know, it was a peaceful operation. As the article goes on, it talks about the fact that even within the Black community, there was a little disagreement about owning land and the purpose of farming. Some did believe that it was important for generational wealth. Others saw it as a stepping stone to get out of working the land. That, for example, if you could send your kids to college, then you had another source of wealth coming in. But you know, this particular family said, you know, the land is who we are, and you become tied to it in, you know, in an identity sort of way. But as the years go on, the couple has three children that are very light-skinned and begin to identify themselves as white. And, you know, before long, the Black owner of the property passes away, and he's not even allowed to be buried in the white cemetery that's nearby. The kids, you know, research this a little bit, and like I say, they identify as white. And so the whole, if you can imagine then that the whole sense of Black ownership of this piece of land was just vaporized in a way, you know, it just ceased to exist. All that remains now, because the children sold the land to a white owner, is this little Black cemetery of people who had worked the land for over 120 years. And, you know, we just thought it was interesting that that there would be a desire not to identify, you know, as even partially Black, the people that did the work, that hung on to this land, I would imagine, with their fingernails, you know, through all of these periods of, like you say, Black codes and, you know, disappointment on debt, inability to get loans and so on. They must have worked really hard to do that. And the grandfather, the Black man, said to his grandson, just put about $1,000 in, then you'll always have this piece of land. And you know, the kid has no idea, you know, how to get $1,000. But what the grandfather, I think, was trying to tell him, it will be worth just keeping the land. Yeah. So in the end, it's gone. And, you know, there are very few farmers and Black farmers in that area. In 1900, there were 300. And then in 1970, it went to 175. And in 2017, there were no Black farmers in this particular county.
And that's so sad. When you,
it's sad,
but at the same time, it's like it's understandable.
Yeah.
Right? Because when you think about the level of brutality, violence, inhumane treatment, when you think about that, which was put upon the people who were enslaved, I can see with the Great Migration why so many people were fleeing the South, simply because it was violent and brutal.
Right. Yeah.
It was violent and brutal. And so a good portion of the people, and not only that, but there were also people that were leaving, you know, leaving, like, I need to go find my family.
Mm. Oh, true.
Right.
You know, there's that piece as well. Mm-hmm. So the Great Migration was, you know, these refugees in a lot of ways getting out of these deplorable, horrendous conditions.
Backbreaking,
arduous, punishing, brutal, all of that. Like, who would want to stay in that?
Right.
And so that connection to the land was broken. But what I'm seeing is, as I listen to some of the other farmers, because I've met some other people, like you all know, I met the little girl from Georgia, the little
Kendall Ray.
Yeah, Kendall Ray. And she's a farmer and she grows food. People can subscribe on her farm. They were able to work it so that people who have an EBT card, where they get assistance from the government to buy their food, they are able to go to Kendall Ray's farm and get fresh fruits and vegetables.
And this is really just an urban or suburban
area. This is like in the heart of Atlanta, like around the corner from where my daughter lived. There's this farm, you know.
And so the girl had that vision. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And so many other instances when you know, you think about the thing with cooperative farming and all of that, and just cooperative economics in general, it's really a sad state. So I look at it from the standpoint of supporting the farmers in any way that I can. And I look at us, you know, sort of having this conversation, putting it out there, go and find information, look up John Boyd, look up all of these farmer associations and farming groups, because they are there and they need help. And they need,
like John said, we all need to eat.
Exactly.
And if we're not doing this, you're not going to be able to eat.
Exactly.
I just wanted to finish this story with the top quote in the article.
Yes.
If you recall, the original Black farmer's name was Addie Stepp. The first line is, everybody's got good things to say about Addie. And I just thought it was so funny. Why do you have to start out that way?
Right.
Because they were saying, he's nice, even though he was a Black guy. So we were.
Oh, yeah.
So we're going to say something good about him.
Of course.
Yeah. He's not unusual. He was a nice guy. Wow. Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah. And so one of the things that the three of us has talked about in the past is the show Queen Sugar. Mm-hmm. That is an amazing show. And I think one of the things, the cinematography is amazing. Like everything about that show, I really, really like. But the thing that really, the theme that runs through it is this idea of this family trying to hold on to their land. And when they talk about the history of that particular piece of land, it turns out that they are in the center of white farms all around them. So there's this always this tug of war, so to speak, where they're trying to hold on to their land, and not just this particular family, but other families in that same parish, right? Trying to hold on to their land while the surrounding farmers, which basically are white people, are trying to take it away. And they're doing very underhanded political kinds of things to try to take. The land away. And it's very powerful. It's a very powerful way to get a sort of modern creative view on the stuff that we've been talking about with the issues with Black farmers. And the other thing that is really interesting is that their primary enemy, if you will, the primary food or farming business that's trying to take their land away. When you look at their history, the Black families' history, they were owned by these particular individuals. So here, this is like set in modern day, 21st century is the time period, but then there's this very strong tie back to racism, slavery, and all of that by virtue of the people that I'm sitting here and I'm looking at you, and your legacy is that your family owned my family.
Ugh.
That's something.
They even work side by side.
Never gotten over that loss, right? That they are still fighting to get that back somehow. I mean, it's just in 2000, whatever, right? Whenever this show came out, that's sad.
Yeah, it's a very recent show.
I mean, how many white people are trying to do that against another white farmer?
Right. Exactly. Right? Exactly. And it lets you know, I think fundamentally what it lets you know is that connection to the land is absolutely important and critical. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, why would white people fight so hard for it? Mm-hmm. Right? Yeah.
Oh, good point.
And be so deceptive.
Why would they fight so hard for it if it doesn't mean anything or whatever? It's just not that big a deal.
Not that valuable.
It is a big deal. And again, when you think about generational wealth and how generational wealth is tied to property in this country, it's tied to real estate, it's tied to land and all of that.
Is that about the white farmers wanting to take that land back? Or not wanting to allow a Black farmer to succeed?
I think it's both. They want the land. In that particular show on Queen Sugar, they want the land. They want the land.
Yeah.
And they have no, you know, there's no sentimental connection to the Black family. I mean, in particular, because of that root, the roots that are there, that your family owned my family.
So that's not a connection.
That's some deep stuff.
And then the effect of industrialized farming, I wonder what that does to, you know, all of the small farmers as well. Talk about encroachment.
Right, they can't compete with that.
You know, I need to look up more and more Black businesses, Black-owned farmers, you know, within driving distance of where I live.
Co-ops and things like that. Like, there's a woman that on the Dr. Edna B. McKenzie branch of Asala here in Pittsburgh, we did an episode when I was talking about the little girl in Georgia. We also had a woman who is an urban farmer out of Rochester, New York, that was also on that show. And she's actually one of the people that I'm trying to kind of connect with her so that she can come in and talk about her experience directly with some of this stuff that we're talking about. And so a lot of it is also educating young people. So, you know, I heard somebody say recently that you'd be surprised that the average young person in today's society cannot tell you where a French fry comes from.
Yeah, exactly. Or ketchup.
Right. Or produce, period, in the supermarket. Like, what is the process by which it gets there to your table? What is the process?
That's even sadder. That's
So we're in some interesting times right about now. And so again, for me, the message in all of this is support Black farmers. Go out there, learn, look up the name of Mr. John Boy. There are other people that are connected to this whole thing as well. But it was on Roland Martin's show. If you're familiar with Roland Martin, he had did an episode where Mr. Boyd was there, and he was going in depth into why the lawsuit, the class action lawsuit, was filed. And so he gives you that background information as to how did that come to be, and the fact that it was really perpetrated by white farmers.
Exactly.
And this piece that I looked at on the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights talks about the well-documented discrimination at the hands of the USDA.
Who is
going up against the USDA? I'm sure. I mean, this class action is against them. But you know, how many Black people are working in the USDA? What is it that we can't infiltrate this? And this is just it's just unreasonable, unfair, discriminatory, on and on and on.
Right. It's the same soup warmed over, whether we're talking about in the realm of farming, whether we're talking about equity, diversity, inclusion in corporate America. It's the same soup warmed over multiple times. And you and all of us know, if you take a soup and you keep warming it over and over and over and over, sooner or later, that loses completely any nutritional value that it had. It's got mold in it. It's got all kinds of stuff that's going
polluted.
And that's where we are, kind of in that kind of
place
right now. And, you know, people trying to hold on to that belief system, while that very belief system is what is making the country fall apart.
Exactly.
Think about it. It's that belief system.
Right.
It's based on the loss of integrity and truth and consciousness. And of course it's going to fall apart. It's causing it.
There's a quote from Dorian Spence in this, the article I just mentioned, Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights, that says, through systemic racism in lending, Black farmers, once the backbone of our agricultural system, are having their livelihoods wiped out without promised relief.
Yes.
There it is. the whole thing in one sentence.
That's right there.
That's
right there. And then there's another quote. This was actually a quote from Benjamin Crump, the civil rights attorney.
Right.
Instead, it was 40 acres and a mule all over again, referring to the lawsuit or the killing of the, I mean, you know, the 40 acres was repealed. Now the debt relief is repealed. And this is a function of the government. Right. So he says, instead, it was 40 acres and a mule all over again. 150 years later, broken promises that doomed generations of Black farmers to become sharecroppers and rob Black families of billions in intergenerational wealth.
Ugh.
That's what we're looking at.
That's right.
That's what we're looking at.
And yet the perception of laziness persists, you know.
Of course.
Black people have never stopped fighting, but the label is laziness.
Never been released and let go of.
Right.
When it needs to. It's time. It's over time. It's beyond time.
Oh, yeah.
Goodness. I can't imagine.
When I think about those types of things, the labels and all of that, again, it kind of gets back to something that Mavis alluded to earlier when you were telling the story about your friend at the coffee shop, right? You have to get to the point where you begin to realize that it is your thoughts, your ideas, and your beliefs that are in this whole entire pot of soup that I was talking, that we keep coming over.
Yes, that's right.
You are a part of that, whether you want to acknowledge it, whether you want to own it, whether you want to be, you know, take that step and hold yourself accountable for that. You own a part of all of this.
And because
you silently accept white supremacy, then you are, in fact,
propagating.
Yeah, you're propagating. Yes, you are not innocent, if you will. Everybody in this country plays a role
in
how all of this stuff is playing out, because it's all about what are you bringing into the conversation? What are your thoughts, your ideas, your beliefs, and what is emerging and your words, your actions, and your behaviors. What that gentleman experienced was him going through this critical self-reflection.
And learning
from it.
And learning to step in and continue learning from it, right? If he's planning to continue going back. And you're right, that's what we all can do. We each can have a part in changing this paradigm.
Yeah, it just takes a teeny bit of willingness to look at it. You know, because I just continuously hear a door slamming with even the subject of racism instead of, am I involved in some way?
Right.
That's not a hard thing to do. You know, how might I be participating?
Are my beliefs and my thoughts participating?
Exactly.
Yeah, and then we start seeing, like I saw a few months ago, I might not have noticed that first sentence in that article. Right. Oh, Addie was a nice guy. Nobody had a problem with him.
Right, but you can hear
you just start noticing how racism is dressed up in another way.
Right. Well, and how it still can live within each of us, right?
Yes,
we may not be conscious of, but the more we are curious about that, and the more we are not
curious
judgment, but observation of just our own beliefs and thoughts.
Yeah, curiosity is the key to
change and be a change agent. Yeah,
and that is the crux of the work that I do with the Place to Soar, and when I develop the activism through coaching model. Because the coaching model in general is really about people looking at themselves. That's the first step in the process. You have to be willing to look at yourself. And if you're not willing to do that, and you're not willing to really look at the role that you're playing in perpetuating this problem. That's what I was trying to say earlier, the role that you're playing in perpetuating this problem, then you're just a perpetrator of the problem.
Right. You're not a part of the solution.
Because you have to be willing to look at yourself.
Change. Even as a therapist, somebody coming in for therapy, you have to be willing to look in that mirror and look within yourself, or change is never going to happen, whatever that is you want to work on. And we all have to participate in this change. In this
Thank shift. God there's you out there giving therapy, Gail.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so we have like 1 minute left.
We have to go.
What I'd like you to do is call out your website so people can go and see the other parts of what you all do with your respective nonprofits and all of that. Just real quick, we literally got like 45 seconds.
My nonprofit is seedabetterlife.org. It's about work we're doing in Rwanda.
And my nonprofit is OMA Pittsburgh.org. And we have a variety of different programs that are around youth and around trauma survivors and holistic education. So please check
Excellent.
It out.
Excellent. And of course, you can always go visit The Place to Soar to find out a lot or a little bit, depending on what you're looking for, about the work that I do as a personal transformation expert. I do a lot in this space, this anti-racism activation space. We actually have the first annual anti-racism activation summit that will be coming up in January of 2023. So we'll be putting lots of information out there about that. So I want to thank you for joining us. And we will see you the next time on Inflection Point Podcast here on Transformation Talk Radio. And you know the deal. We are here every first and third Wednesday, 3 p.m. Pacific time, 6 p.m.
Thank you for listening to Inflection Point Podcast, where our mantra is cultivating change from the inside out. The journey towards anti-racism and social change doesn't stop here. Truth, reconciliation, and healing come from ongoing, open, honest, and deliberate conversations. Continue to dive in and deconstruct your thoughts, ideas, and beliefs as we band together to manifest social change. Tune in to Inflection Point Podcast every first and third Wednesday at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern, here on TransformationTalkRadio.com for more conversations about how we can cultivate change from the inside out.
Views expressed on this program are those of the host, guests, and callers, and do not necessarily reflect the views of the station, its management, or advertisers. You're listening to Transformation Talk Radio.